Well, we had a very, very good relationship with one another until for the 3 months that he commanded us. I was not a pleasant man the first day arrived. Nothing to do with him really taking my command, but because I had not got along with him in England when I was there. And I actually asked to be taken away from the Edmonton Regiment. I was told by someone I was the Edmonton Regiment to get back there. And so I returned and I said I would do my best, and I did. And he and I get along famously, and he'd tell you this day, I think we've established on a reasonably firm footing a friendship which lasts now. Bellarmine and I get along quite well with one another. Well, at Piedmont, we did a lot of good training, both physically and particularly in cleaning up and getting more soldier-like again. We were in tents, but everybody had to be clean, laundered, trained physically, and we had the area absolutely spotless, in which we lived. The latrines were all fly-proofed and all that kind of thing. We had several extremely good parties that, again, much as one may say you're playing, but it restores the spirit of a unit to get the officers messed together with the officers from the other units and have a big meal and a booze up and that kind of thing, and it does the troops also.
The sort of thing you weren't able to do then in that terrible winter that you
had. No, we couldn't do it in the winter, but we did it there at Piedmont, and Bell Irving was enough of a taskmaster that he loved to play hard, but he loved to work hard too, and he expected everybody else to work hard, and everybody did. Most people had had some leave somewhere or another. I remember I went to Sorrento, south of Naples, and I had a very wonderful 10 days there, including Capri and Pompeii and
beautiful part of the world, of course.
Lovely part of the world. You know, see Naples and die.
Yeah.
And that was an absolute fact. And one made some lovely acquaintances. As a single man, I found outlets for all the lusts of the flesh that have been denied for a long time. I must say, I had a really good time. I came back from there a new man, completely and utterly. Everything healed from nervous systems and stomachs and everything else. We're all back in shape, and I was in first-class form when I got back to the unit. We then, first of all, we moved to Florence, which was a kind of a false move to deceive, because there was no intention of us fighting there. I remember going up to Florence, and the Arno River, there was practically no, it was dry at the time, just about, as most Italian rivers in the summertime, once the spring freshet goes, there's nothing to stop the water galloping to the sea, which it does in a hurry. One thing I remember when we were going into town was that the New Zealanders had been in there, they were coming out, and it was a Maori company was in the area we were going into. And they had trucks loaded with everything you could dream of. Ladies' shoes. I remember this one truck was piled with ladies' shoes. I presume trading stock, you know. Scarf had been very scarce in Italy.
Yeah.
When I was there, I went over to a rather large house, castle. There was an American woman who had married an Italian who was the chatelaine of this place. And she started in a great tirade about these blacks. He's talking about these Maoris. You know. So I had to give her a little lesson in patriotism about I presume she was not pro-German. Although I didn't know whether she was or not, but I presume she was. And that these so-called black people were not black. They were Maori's fine New Zealanders, and they had just done a great job in pushing the Germans back out of town. But she didn't appreciate the way I lectured her, because she wanted to know who was my superior officer. And I said, there's no officer in the world superior to me. However, we were only there about 2 days, and one of the really sad incidents happened. I had to go back from there to behind the line to prepare a staging area to bring the battalion up, because we'd done our job and we'd put a patrol across the Arno to identify ourselves in Florence. And I had a recce party, and we'd taken jeeps and things from the pioneer platoon and from the anti-tank platoon for this party. And one of the trailers was being pulled behind one of the jeeps, loaded with beehives, which were a very, very form of very high explosive. It was a mine. It was so built that it threw all the charge forward into one funnel. They looked like a beehive to look at them. And I'd left a captain by the name of Stevens with this jeep and told him to look for an area for a support company, because they had to have roads and places, buildings, perhaps they could conceal their vehicles by. They were all that good. And he was a member of that company anyhow. And I was about half a mile from where I left him. I heard an explosion that sounded just like that mountain blowing the other day. Yeah. Just like some of the hell was going. And so I drove back as quick as I could. There was a hole in the middle of the road as big as a house. There was a jeep wheel on top of a roof. Where the rest of the jeep was, I don't know. And there were cannons running around, wounded, holding their arms, bleeding. And I didn't want it to happen. And I said to an old lady who had two or three words of English, what happened? And she said, tall boy, meanin'. And I realized then that lying alongside the road were much of these Italian box mines, and they were long box mines, and they had a lid that was open. If you close the lid, that's what blew it. Yeah. And that's the way they put them on the road, put a bit of dust over them, and the tank would go over top of the lid, would close, and up it would bang. And apparently this fellow, Foster, this private soldier with poor old Stevens, he had stood on top of this load of beehives with one of these things in his hand, trying to see how it worked. And apparently he closed it, and bang, up with all these beehives, which is a half a ton of the highest explosive in the world that went at that time.
Oh my God.
We buried Foster in a pail, little bits we found of hair. Nobody found his dog tag or anything like that. We called it Foster and put it in the ground. Poor old Stevens had his head off and one leg gone. And that was a very, very sad kind of an incident.
Yes, it certainly was.
Well, we pulled from there and we went to where we were going to start fighting our next battle, which was known as the Battle of the Gothic Line.
I wondered if you would give us a few words, if you will, on the equipment and supply factor, the weight of armament. Were there any cases where you were short when you felt you shouldn't be? And generally, everything worked in accordance with the way it was supposed to, and comments on that nature.
Well, I think the best way I can put that is that I remember at one time, just after Ortona, when we were limited to 5 rounds per gun per day on the front, but that's the only time that I ever heard of any restriction on using anything. The thing that stands out with me in the fighting was the way the Germans handled their shortages. They were still pulling their guns with horses. You still came across their guns with wooden wheels. The amount of ammunition that they had to shoot was very, very sparse. Every now and then they would could dig up perhaps what I would imagine was 5-10 rounds per gun per battery, but certainly no major artillery shoots. Mm-hmm. And still they fought on and on. And then again we had complete supremacy in the air. We saw a few German tanks, or a few German airplanes around in Sicily, a couple of times in Italy, but never in any very large numbers. My headquarters was bombed once, so I'm talking about company headquarters, but only little light bombing, whereas we had the Desert Air Force diving in on targets, and they were reputed to be the best dive bombers in the world. The only thing is, you had to be very careful they knew where the bomb line was, or you'd get it, not the enemy. But the Germans, I felt, considering that they were so short of supplies and that they were working on that Russian front where they had such terrible fighting, they were preparing the West Wall for repelling the invasion they knew must come, and still they put this fantastic resistance against us with so little to fight. I think it boils right down to well-trained, disciplined soldiers, and also, of course, some of the cleverest tacticians in the world. I often wonder if the Germans had the same materiel that the Allies had, what would have happened, even though we had the weighted numbers. I really think that they're an absolutely supreme class of training. Based in good military stock, which no one but a fool would say the Germans aren't, produced the kind of soldiers who did the battling that we faced.
Yeah, their infantry weapons, their light weapons, were, of course, very good.
Excellent. They were excellent weapons, and they could handle them so well. And their minor tactics were so well taught to their people. And they could deploy so few men who would do so much. And I think this is probably the secret of their success in making us fight hard. And anybody that tells me that that the Germans were poor soldiers or didn't fight well, they're talking to the wrong man. Because I had the greatest respect for them.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, when I got through Ortona, somebody said to me, if you had to do this all over again, what kind of troops would you like? And I said, a battalion of German paratroops.
Oh, that's very interesting, Colonel. So now we'll pick this up the next time, then, if that's okay. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. I'm W.S. Thackeray, and I'm continuing with Colonel J.R. Stone, 3rd of June, 1980. Okay, Colonel Stone, we're ready to go.
Well, perhaps before I discuss the Gothic Line battle, I could mention the training that we had in the Piedmont area, which was to ready us for the type of battle they thought that we would run into in that country. Particular stress was placed on the infantry come tank battle, which had rather failed in the Hitler line through the Luri Valley. And we'd had with us a British tank brigade commanded by a gentleman by the name of Dawney, who afterwards became the chief of the Imperial General Staff. During this training, we had found great difficulty in the communication between the man on the ground, the company or the platoon commander, and the tanks themselves. And the set issued at that time for that purpose was the 26 set, which in itself was absolutely hopeless. This led to rather an amusing incident. After an exercise with the tanks, there was a critique, and Brigadier Dawney mentioned something about how successful it had been, and one of his
tank squadron commanders, rose to his feet and said it would be fine if the wireless sets would work. And so Brigadier Dawney, no doubt making sure he was going to be the chief of the Imperial General Staff and getting along with the politicians, said anything the War Office issues works. And and he rather bullied this squadron commander. And that evening at a party, and everybody was had a few drinks, I went up to him and told him that he had been unfair with this squadron commander. And he waggled his finger at me and said, "The trouble with you is you think you know too much." And so I waggled my finger right back and I said, "The trouble with you is you use your red tabs to bully your subordinates."
That must have been a popular thing to say.
The situation was saved by General Vokes coming to the rescue and parting us before it came to fisticuffs.
The AO-26 set was pretty unreliable, wasn't it?
Very unreliable.
Yeah.
And it was not a fixed crystal. And it wandered off net. And another thing, to try and communicate with a tank with all that metal around it, and the person on the ground who was usually in a precarious position when trying to call for tank help, it was pretty hopeless to expect anything but the very finest of equipment to work.
How did you carry your 26 sets?
They're carried on man packs.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what was issued to the tanks?
Yes, well, that's right. They had one particular purpose.
Yeah.
They, of course, had their own tank communication, which were much better sets. They worked well. And also, where a squadron commander was operating with a company commander who could talk two tanks on the tank net, it was fine. It was only with the man on the ground, the platoon commander or something, trying to get in touch with a troop commander or a tank to say, somebody bothering me over there that caused the trouble.
Yeah. Whatever happened about this, would communications ever improve or not?
Not then. By the time, of course, when they got back, when the war was over, and they got back to these two sets that were working on crystals that were, held the frequency and weren't varied, they didn't go off net, it started to work quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And I have nothing to do with infantry tank the last 20 years, but I would think that right now it's pretty successful.
Hopefully it's improved, yeah.
Oh, it's pretty successful now, I would think. Well, the move out of the Piedmont area, before we got into the Gothic Line proper, we had close to 100 miles of busing. The Germans had made a big pullback over a lot of country that was not suitable for their purpose, which was to fight a delaying action. And they pulled back to the area of across the Matoro River. I remember, particularly on our own front, was quite a large hill called Monte Lura, which we actually eventually took. During this move across the country, we got through some wonderful country of Siena, Perugia, where the very finest of Chianti, Italian Chianti, is made. And I remember we were buying a Ricasoli's Chianti for a shilling a bottle, which was pretty good. Of course, it had to be good proper year before you pay a shilling for it.
Yeah, times have changed.
Times have changed now, that's right. Well, we crossed the Matoro, and we made our first attack, made a very successful advance. But mind you, we had a fantastic amount of artillery support. They were just tremendous, the guns that were firing. And just to give you an idea of what the Germans had to retaliate with, after we passed over this first, took our first objective there, we captured seven horses and several of their guns, which I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. that they were playing with horse-drawn transport. As a matter of fact, we had three quite good saddle horses out of it, a big sorrel gelding and two brown mares, and Bell Irving and I used to do a lot of riding with these things. I hadn't been on a horse for several years, and I really enjoyed these horses. As a matter of fact, I used the sorrel a bit, just after the action. I didn't ride it in the battle or anything like that, but I remember running into General Alexander just after one of the fights, and I was on horseback. I think he thought it was funny to see a foot soldier come down on the hillside on a horse, particularly with a peculiar German saddle on it. However, these horses were very welcome, and we kept them until the battalion left Italy. And I remember, as I'm discussing the horses, I remember we had a farm going at that time. I had a shell-shocked Swede who we had to do something with, and we started to gather up turkeys because I was determined we were going to have a good turkey dinner in 1944. And I found an abandoned farm and installed the Swede in this place with the turkeys, and he had some chickens and these three saddle horses, which when we were out of the line, mm-hmm. He looked after them. And when we left Italy, the question came up, what was going to happen to the saddle horses? So I said, well, you can sell them to Italian farmers who were, desperate for stock, and use the money to buy fifes and drums for a band, because I've always wanted a fife and drum band. So there were communication with Boozy and Hawks, who pointed out the fifes were in short supply, but however, they would probably have some around. But unfortunately, the horses were sold, and the money was changed from lira to guilders, and they got into Holland, but it never did get back to Canada. I have an idea that there were the parties that were carrying on with from Holland to Canada. My drum and fife money went there.
Went into the party.
However, I hope my sorrel horse didn't finish up in too rough a home. Some of the Italians are pretty tough on horses, and I would hate to think of that. Well, we started. One of the objectives we had, there was a place called Monte Chicago, and the company commander of B Company got killed there, and it was a rather fluid situation with that battle. And I found out when I got up there that the commander was killed, and the CSM was captured, and he was a young man by the name of Morris, the CSM. And when I came back in the army to go to Korea, who arrived as one of the company sergeant majors of 2nd PPCLI, but Morris. And he retired from the army of rather a portly major. And he's still living in Edmonton right now. The historian of the Royal Edmonton Regiment has said that the Sicilian campaign was a scramble, the drive up Italy a trek, Ortona an individual achievement, the Lyre Valley a tragedy, but the Gothic line proved that the corps, the division, the brigade, and the battalion were parts of a machine which really functioned. And so when one considers how long we had been in Sicily and Italy, which is just over a year when this happened, according to the historian, it really took that long to get the whole division and probably the corps functioning for more or less a set-piece battle and doing it properly. And that was the reason, with, of course, the weight of metal we had, that we achieved such success in the Gothic line. The Germans, admittedly, hadn't completed their preparations. They had had a, the Tout organization, their big engineering group, had been back, conscripted Italians, and were digging fortifications to beat the devil. But we moved a little faster up the country than they expected, and they weren't really ready, although they had a lot of well dug in emplacements and that kind of thing. But it wasn't as well prepared as the Lurie Valley was when the hinterland. I was, let me say this, that Bell Irving was a well-educated soldier. He was a good commanding officer, and the battalion functioned very well under him, and he had with him a tanker with a name that's quite famous in Canadian history, actually, Van Strabenzi. But this man commanded the, last time I met him, he commanded the 4th Hussars, but he was commanding a tank battalion in Italy. And a very good man he was, too. And between he and Bell Irving, we took our objectives, the battalion, without an abnormal loss of life. There was, of course, there were casualties, but it was well fought and well directed. And I look back on it as some of the better soldiering. I would agree with the historian that there wasn't really too much professionalism when you look back at it. I again, compared with the Germans, we were professional. Yeah. We were hardly as professional as the Brits. But I think the Gothic Line battle proved that we could be, and we were in that. Do you mind?
Okay, here we are back.
after we had captured Monte Loro and had got beyond that, the battle pushed on, and we moved to the Adriatic for a short rest. And what a wonderful rest it was. There were beautiful beaches. At Catalica was the actual town we were in. Beautiful beaches. My saddle horse and the one B.I. used to ride, we galloped up on the sand on the beaches and really enjoyed life. We did a little bit of fishing for sardines by using high explosives. Matter of fact, we cooked them like whitebait, but they were very, very interesting. And matter of fact, we had Lord Tweesmere one time fed him on some. This is B.I. and I, we cooked together on this thing. Well, after a spell there where we did a certain amount of training with weapons. We were getting reinforcements from Canada, who had not a complete even weapon training. And I remember some of them had never seen a 36 grenade. Some had never fired a 2-inch mortar. Matter of fact, quite a few of them. And so I had got these classes going quite strongly. And about that time, the Minister of National Defense, Ralston, came out. And when he came along with quite a large group of his of staff officers from Corps, he came along and asked me how things were. And so I told him very frankly that the training, the state of training of the reinforcement was frightful. So he said, well, I can hardly believe that. I go to the camps in Canada, and they show me their troops, and he said they seem to me to be quite well trained. And I said to him, well, of course, you see the show squad. The ones they send us, they hide in the kitchen while they were there, and they bring their show squad out. And he said, well, I can't really believe that. And I said, well, if you have the time, I'll get 5 or 6 fellows who've just come over. And I'll demonstrate to you that they don't know anything about at least 2 weapons. So he said, well, I haven't got time, so I must take your word for it. But it was very true that the training camps in Canada were basically not doing a good job on
the basics. Would this have been a problem partly brought about by the demand for reinforcements and the fact that reinforcements were getting scarce in Canada? And if you run around to a an infantry training school and say, I'm looking for overseas volunteers. I mean, you took anybody you put up their hand down there, but at that point, I should think. There was something, I think, in that. I don't know how much. Or was that?
Yeah.
Would you comment on that at all? Or?
Well, I, you know, having been an old weapon trainer, if people would follow the old British Army manuals, you can make anybody, not an expert in weapons, but good with weapons, if you just follow what they tell you to do, and it doesn't take very long. But the biggest trouble is that you get the officer's mess and the sergeant's mess and everybody else wanting servants, and they pull them, instead of the men doing training, their training's broken, they're going to do their bit of doing it, being anything. Whereas if you're really going to train an army, the thing to do is to get a bunch of broken down old civilian help. For instance, their veterans guard would have been ideal to have put some of those fellows in to do that kind of work, and let the young men spend their time learning to be soldiers. In 3 months, you could turn them out well trained. But if you're going to spend 3 months, break it up, the training broken, having to be servants, then it'll take 6 months, and even then, because the sequence of training is lacking, and the great secret of using the old British Army pamphlet teaching weapons was to keep the sequence and follow one lesson with another, and in the end you became an expert when you got through with it.
I suppose when the sequence gets broken, sometimes you would miss some of the weapons that you should have otherwise been in.
Some of the lessons in the weapons, and that's what did happen, just too much.
Hmm.
Well, after we moved from the it's one trip from the Adriatic, we were down there around Catalica. We went into, again, the fighting through the same kind of country that we'd been fighting before, and again the Germans were fighting a series of delaying battles, hoping to be able to complete a good winter line further back. It happened to be, eventually we found out, hinged on Ravenna on the sea, and swing over, well, following very much the Senio, the country we were in, the Senio River, its dike bank. That's where they did establish a line in the end, and they were trying to delay as much as possible, and that's the kind of fighting we went in. Well, in this, I remember the next series of fighting we did, that for the first time I ran into the use of artificial moonlight, the use of searchlights put onto the clouds to light up the battlefield. Now, I understand that had been done in the First War, and I believe Andy McNaughton was the man who introduced it in the First War, and then it had been almost forgotten, and somebody had dug this up. And because we were having trouble moving in the dark, this was introduced, and it was great, because it silhouetted the enemy. The light came out, but then you moved in darkness, because the light was shining way over you, and it was just reflecting down. And something that should be, any time there's going to be ground battles fought, something should be considered. Of course, nowadays, with this so much accuracy with rockets, that the battery would turn its light on once and it would be knocked out. And I presume you'd do the same thing with infrared that we were doing with searchlights. But at that time, it certainly worked well for us, and we were very happy to have them.
Who provided the searchlights?
There were searchlight batteries over there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, the British.
Yeah.
We didn't have any, but the British had them. Well, the next real fighting that we had was on San Fortunato Ridge, which was again in that series of hills which started at the Mataro and went on to a river called the Marecchio. There's a group of semi-mountainous features in between. They're not really mountains, but they were high ridges, and they they made great defensive country. San Fortunato Ridge, we had a really tough fighting in it, and I think possibly that was one of our hardest fought battles. Again, Barbering was in command. But it was a bit scrambled. I remember there was a road running straight across the front of Fort Nader Ridge, and it was being held by the West Nova Scotians. And I was second in command, but the place I never would stay was back in P Echelon, and I was wandering around the front, seeing what was going on, and I got ahead of the FDLs, and I found a sunken road, a road cut right down between the hills, and ran through the ridge, and there was a long spur that went out to the valley of the Marecho River. And I think the name of the town on the other end was San Lorenzo, something or another, but it was named like San Lorenzo, and it was a small town, large village down there, stone buildings, normal Italian place. And I was moving along this road, and there was a building with a red cross on the door, and I could hear voices in there, and I listened, and I was sure they were Germans, and the last thing I wanted to do was to be captured in broad daylight, wandering around the front. So I got back, and when I got back to battalion, the thing had been launched. The attack bogged down during the afternoon, and Bill Irving decided to attack at night. And he put this night attack in, and luckily, John Dugan, who was commanding a platoon in D Company, stumbled on this sunken road, moved up it, and with a fantastic charge on this narrow ridge, the road was sitting on top, he ran down there with his company. The Germans were so surprised, Dugan hit one of them over the head with the butt of his rifle, and his platoon took this long, well, it was a call, if you will, but it was a village, a small town there, and they took it over. And then by daylight, they were secure on it. And Dugan, by the way, got a bar to his MC for the thing.
The officers carried rifles in these attacks.
We used to carry them. I carried one all through Korea, too.
Yeah.
Pistol wasn't much use.
Wasn't much good.
No. And I like rifles, and so Dugan had one. He swung this little, like, club and hit the guy. Perhaps they're as useful that way as they are in the other one. Anyhow, Dugan, it was a pretty dangerous position. And because I'd been up the sunken road, I called and got two of our anti-tank guns, battalion and six-pounders, up. And I led them up the road and deployed them, covering the flanks of this thing so it couldn't be attacked from the sides. And it was a great job. The troop sergeant of the anti-tanks, he got a DCM, and I must say I got a DSO, or my little bit, around there. And that, of course, broke the hinterline. The Gothic line. There were two or three on Fort Nader Ridge, two or three magnificent houses. I remember one was called the Villa Belvedere, and the other was called the something Paradiso, and one meaning beautiful view, I guess, and the other one meaning paradise. but this. I remember going in, I think the patricians were in Paradiso, and I remember seeing exhausted soldiers, taking 6-foot pictures off the wall, canvases, and lying on them, and of course the thing is smashing into 1,000 pieces, tiny little bit, this very, very old canvas, probably dating from 1500.
They were trying to use them as beds.
Beds, yeah, I was just tired. And there was quite a bit of looting went on, and I forget, some prince owned it, and there was a bit of a fuss about it. I don't suppose it's ever written into history, but we had orders afterwards that anybody that had anything that came out of this place was to return it, because he put a claim in for $2 million for the stuff that had been taken. And I remember I'd taken a caravan. I was then commanding. I'd take the caravan over from the Seaforth, and in it was the most beautiful silver fruit bowl. And it had been presented to one of the ancestors by the Empress Eugenie.
Oh, my gosh.
It, It was worth, it was valued $9,000 when the on the valuation list. And there was a map in a web silver tray and a peasant girl's head. I didn't want it. The one thing during the war, I committed every other sin, but I never did loot. Mm-hmm. It was against my principles, mm-hmm. for one thing. And so this thing went back, but I believe it was stolen. But the inquiry all finished when Sir Richard McCreary, who was commanding 8th Army, is reputed to have said, when it was brought to his attention, this claim and everything else, he said, "Who is this Italian of rather dubious political leanings that dares question the integrity of my Canadian soldiers?" I've torn the whole thing up.
Oh, dear.
If you only knew the integrity of pretty slippy stuff. However, when Fort Notter Ridge was taken, the country beyond the Mercio River is the flat Po Valley country. It's all river lines, boggy country, and but no one, some great map strategist, had looked at this piece of flat plain and said, "Ha, this is where the armor will go." So we were sitting on the high ground, and clouds of dust were coming. One day came up for 2 days, and it was the New Zealand Armored Division, and they were going to pass through us. And the thing was debouch into the Valley of the Po. I remember we made up a song about it afterwards.
Unfortunately, they were going kind of going the wrong way, weren't they? Going across it instead of up it.
That's right. Debouch into the Valley of the Po.
I think if we may stop just here a minute, and I'll change tapes, and then we'll carry on with it.
All right.